From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Facebook was justified in its decision to boot former President Trump from the platform earlier this year. That's according to an oversight board that ruled on his case today. The board says while Facebook was right to ban the former president for inciting violence during the Capitol insurrection, the company imposed a, quote, arbitrary penalty when it suspended Trump's accounts indefinitely. The board recommends Facebook review the case over the next 6 months. This verdict is the first major test of the board, which Facebook set up last year, to review its decisions on what to take down from the site and what to leave up. And we want to note that Facebook is a financial sponsor of NPR. Let's bring in Noah Feldman. He actually helped set up Facebook's oversight board, and he's a professor at Harvard Law School, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes. So, Noah, you're not a member of this board, but you did help create it. Your thoughts on the board's decision today, are you surprised?
I am a little surprised, and I'm also happy because the board acted like a court would have acted. They held Facebook to account by saying that it had not articulated clear standards for why it suspended Trump indefinitely. But at the same time, it was realistic enough to understand that under the conditions of January 6, Facebook was right to take Trump down. And the body gave, the oversight board gave Facebook 6 months now in which to get it right and figure out rules and then apply those rules in a fair and even way to Trump. So it was a bit of a compromise decision in that way. It had something for the company and something for Trump and for his supporters. But I think ultimately it was cautious, wise, and reasonable.
You know, when this ban happened, there was a lot of criticism that this was basically an affront to free speech. We'll probably be hearing a lot more of that criticism over the next few days. How would you respond to these concerns about what this means for free speech?
The board's opinion really tried, I think, pretty explicitly, if you read it, to say that free speech needs protecting and that the way to protect it is with clear rules that specifically delineate in advance what it would mean to break those rules and why someone should be taken off the platform. And they said really clearly that those rules should follow principles not unlike the ones in the First Amendment, namely that speech should only be taken down if it has an imminent threat to do real harm. I think, you know, the board was right to say that Facebook did follow that on January 6th when there was real danger and when the mob was actually invading the Capitol. But I also think the board was right to say that afterwards, Facebook needs to actually do a careful analysis of whether allowing Donald Trump on the platform would threaten imminent harm. I mean, that is an important free speech principle.
Right. And the board also said it wasn't fair for the company to ban Trump indefinitely. Now that this decision is essentially back where it started, I mean, in the hands of Facebook and its very powerful CEO, Mark Zuckerberg. So from your point of view, the other thought I have is, what function did the board actually serve here?
What the board did is that it told the company that the solution that it came up with, this indefinite suspension, was the wrong one, that it needs to have what it doesn't have presently, clear rules that say, if you break this rule, you get your content taken down. You do two or three or however many you have to say in advance, then you could be taken off the platform. And, you know, at the same time, the board also told Facebook, you have to make this public and transparent and clear to users. So that's something that would not have been in place if it weren't for the board's decision. And in that way, the board engaged in oversight. It's called the Oversight Board for a reason. It engaged in oversight, and it said to Facebook, you didn't do it exactly right. Go back and do it better now, and do it better in a way that in the future will produce fairer and clearer outcomes.
Well, going back, though, to the significance of this decision, the board also made recommendations on how Facebook should improve its policies. But these policies are not binding. So do you expect this decision will have any real impact on how the company operates going forward?
I'm very confident that it will. You know, a minority of the board, and they reported this in their opinion, wanted to make some of the commands binding. But I think what the board was saying is, here are principles you have to follow. You have to follow the principles of free expression. And then it said, go forth and write the rules that will comprise or consist alongside with these principles. I think had the board written those rules itself, it probably wouldn't have done as good a job because, frankly, its members aren't experienced in creating content moderation standards for a service with billions of users on it. So it's appropriate to make Facebook take that responsibility in the first instance, and then for the board to engage in oversight and make sure that those decisions and those rules follow principles. And here they said that the principles need to be followed, that they haven't been, and it's appropriate then to tell Facebook, go back and do it again.
Traditional media organizations like newspapers or public radio programs make decisions every day about what to allow on their platforms. But is Facebook really the same thing? I mean, they've argued over the last few years that they're not in the category of being a media company. How does this ruling impact this larger argument on whether Facebook should be playing by the other rules of media and journalism organizations?
To me, what the Oversight Board's creation shows, and this decision underscores it, is that Facebook is a little different from a newspaper or a radio deciding through the editorial process what to publish. But it's also different from just being an open forum where anybody can say whatever they want any of the time. Instead, what social media companies like Facebook do is they let you post your content, but then they have rules that dictate what content you can and can't post. And they have rules, or they should have rules, dictating when you would be punished by being taken off the platform. And that's what the Oversight Board is there to do. It's there to make sure that they have clear standards, clear rules, and clear principles, and to defend our free expression in that same way.
That's Noah Feldman, a professor at Harvard Law School, who helped set up the Oversight Board at Facebook, which today said the company was right to ban former President Trump from its platforms. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Well, remember COVID-19 testing? This time last year, it was one of the few tools that health officials had to monitor and contain the spread of the coronavirus. Now, much of the focus has shifted to vaccinations, but experts say testing still matters. Connecticut Public Radio's Nicole Leonard spent time at a testing site in Hartford and has this report.
Part of the parking lot at the Coppell Community Sports Center is sectioned off with orange cones to make way for a drive-through COVID-19 testing station. Carlos Rodriguez pulls up just after 1 o'clock, and there's no line.
All set. Your results will be in 2 or 3 days. All right. Have a good one.
The entire process, including registration and a self-administered nasal swab, takes about 15 minutes. Rodriguez is then on his way home.
Like right now, I got tested because I work at the restaurant. I'm a little sick, but I know it's a common cold, but to basically make sure, I just wanted to get tested.
Many people say testing provides some peace of mind, especially while they wait to become fully vaccinated or because they need to be cleared for work, school, or travel. But activity at testing sites is a bit quieter these days.
It used to be a busy day was like 200 people or more.
That's Patrick Wiley, a support staff worker with Community Health Center, Inc., which runs the testing site.
Now, I mean, today was maybe a little bit busy around lunchtime when we had, 10 or so people to register at the same time.
Jessica Herrera oversees the center's COVID-19 testing efforts and says testing is still a necessary step, considering the fast spread of coronavirus variants. She added that people are letting down their guards or ignoring CDC safety guidelines.
Everybody's getting out and back into their normal lives again, but it's just more possible contamination.
Herrera says the health centers have no plans right now to scale back their services and encourages anyone with COVID-19 symptoms to seek testing. As of mid-April, a rolling 7-day average showed about 30,000 COVID-19 tests performed each day in Connecticut. But those numbers are down from daily averages in the fall and winter. Josh Jabal, the state's chief operating officer, says testing numbers can bounce around, sagging at times, but increasing when cases spike.
I think you've seen a mix to some degree. We have a lot of hospitals are kind of testing everybody that's coming in or out of the hospital for a procedure. It's maybe dropped off in some other areas, but the volumes overall still give us a very good pulse of the activity across the state.
Jabal's office says Connecticut is no longer seeing large testing lines in pop-up clinics like it did around Thanksgiving, and that testing has shifted more to medical settings and for people who are sick. But Stephen Kissler, a research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, says doing rank-and-file surveillance testing in communities remains key to controlling COVID-19.
If we start seeing clusters of cases emerging in places where we wouldn't expect them to, that gives us a lot of information that tells us that we might want to look there for a variant of concern. And the more testing we're doing, the more quickly we'll be able to pick those sorts of things up.
Amish Adalja, a senior scholar and physician at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, says as more people are vaccinated, testing demand will probably drop off. But, he says,
testing could still play a major role. If we could get, for example, cheap home tests where people could test themselves every day and know their status, I think we would come a long way to opening things back up safely. But this has sorely been lacking from the very beginning. I think that testing has been basically the original sin of this pandemic. We've never been able to do it well in the United States.
Health experts say it will be difficult for the country to reach herd immunity against the coronavirus. So testing will be needed for the foreseeable future to identify new cases. For Here and Now, I'm Nicole Leonard.
And Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill contributed to her report. So let's take stock of this political moment we're in. Today, Facebook's oversight board upheld that company's decision to ban former President Trump, at least for now. He was kicked off the social media platform the day after that deadly January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill. After a storm of criticism that he used Facebook to gin up the attack, then didn't do anything to stop it or condemn the attackers. But also today, Congressman Steve Scalise, the second-ranking Republican in the House, became the first GOP leader to publicly call for ousting number three leader Liz Cheney because of her criticism of Trump for his lies about the election that led to that insurrection. What a time to be a political strategist. We've convened our weekly panel. This week, Matt Mikowiak, the Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Robin.
And then Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm okay, but what a day. Matt, former President Trump posted on a new website that he created just yesterday. It's called From the Desk of Donald J. Trump, that his free speech rights have been taken away because his opponents are afraid of the truth. And he once again claimed the election was stolen, which it wasn't. What are you thinking as you watch your party, the Republican Party, hold on to that lie and maybe push out Liz Cheney for calling it out?
Yeah, look, it's a disruptive moment in our party, and it's not that unusual when you lose the White House. Jamal remembers all too well when the Democrats lose the White House, you go into a wilderness period where your party goes through introspection and there's some kind of an uprising. And until you have a nominee 3 years later, you really don't have one central leader. And that's kind of where we are right now. What's unusual is we have a one-term president who was defeated, who is making all the kind of decisions and setting out the direction that he intends to run again. Normally, when someone is defeated, they kind of go off and go away, and there's an opportunity for other people to step forward. Mm-hmm. So, look, you know, I think there's an emerging consensus that Trumpism without Trump may be the best possible pathway. And what I mean by that is Trump's agenda, not his behavior, not his statements, not some of the conspiracies, but his agenda. I think is a winning agenda, particularly if someone else without his baggage can step forward, whether that's Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida or someone else. But Liz Cheney, you know, she's taken a position that's a 10 or 20% position among Republicans around the country, and even probably fewer than that. I think you had 10 or something that voted to impeach in the House. It's hard to maintain a leadership position. A leader doesn't have any followers. It's just a guy or a girl taking a walk. And that's, I think, where she is at the moment. She's a little bit too far out on the limb, substance aside.
Oh, Matt, I've got to get Jamal in here, but I want to ask briefly, what is President Trump's agenda?
No, the agenda he ran on was what I'm talking about, right? It's executing the laws, enforcing the laws on immigration. It's rebuilding the military. It's non-interventionism. It's, you know, conservative judges, tax cuts, deregulation, all those kinds of issues. That agenda, I think, can be a winning agenda again. But I think with Trump and the baggage and the controversies, it's going to be tough.
Well, it's tough because the only thing Americans are hearing right now is that President Trump is spreading a lie that an election was stolen. Jamal, I want to ask you about that. But Matt's, you know, talking about Trump as possible candidate. And here's his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, on Fox News this morning.
There are discussions now about him actually going back out to have rallies and rally America for what it's all about. America first. Joe Biden is all about America last. It's about putting forth that contrast. We've not seen the last of Donald Trump as a candidate.
How far along are those?
Jamal, what do Democrats do in this moment?
Well, first of all, it's a little nervous making as an American, even more than as a Democrat. I think everybody should take this moment very seriously. Donald Trump is an autocratic figure who has been peddling a lie and getting an entire political party to buy into that lie as the basis of their political ascendancy, right? So if we buy into that, and there are enough people who seem to believe it, that there, you know, this could pose a challenge. Any Republican nominee is bound to get 43% of the vote, almost without trying, right? That gets you perilously close to the presidency. And so imagine if the last 4 years that we went through, where we've had such disarray and so many people died during the pandemic, which not all of them were Donald Trump's fault, but certainly the government didn't do everything it could to keep everybody safe. I think that's a real challenge, and we have to take it seriously and decide whether or not this is the course. And Republicans have to decide whether or not this is a course they think they want the country to go on.
Yeah, Matt, I want to ask you that too. I think I'm hearing in your voice a little nervousness. I mean, this is not, you know, some people might see President Trump, former President Trump, as a cartoon character, but he's a cartoon character, if that's what you think he is, who unleashed a mob on the Capitol. That's frightening. And so I want to ask you if you think your party, the Republican Party, is, you know, immolating or, you know, forging and getting stronger, you know, as if we needed any more hints that Liz Cheney was losing her leadership position because of her truth-telling about Trump. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy caught on a hot mic on Fox News yesterday.
I think she's got real problems. I've had it with her. It's, you know, I've lost confidence.
I've lost confidence in Liz Cheney. Matt, where is your party going?
Well, you have 10 members of the House that are Republicans who voted to impeach the president. You have, like, I don't know, Jamal, you might know the number off the top of your head, but you need 218 votes to have a majority. We're 5 votes short of a majority. You can do the math. We're a 212 or something like that. So you have a situation where you have a person in leadership who took a position on a major issue that only 10 out of 202 members took, right? And so it doesn't mean she can't be a member of Congress. It doesn't mean she can't represent her constituency or her state. It doesn't mean she can't make her own decisions. It just means you can't serve as conference chair when on a major issue that you continue to talk about, you're out of step with the conference. You know, you just, again, a leader without a follower is a guy taking a walk. And that's unfortunately the position she's in. I think she's an extraordinary member of Congress. She's very bright. She was Undersecretary of State during the Bush-Cheney administration. She has moral clarity and courage and is an effective communicator and an effective member of Congress. But I think being conference chair is probably not something that's going to continue. And you can tell with McCarthy and Scalise both, you know, signaling this thing is going to end fairly soon. That said, we are going to be cruising for primaries next year, where it appears former President Trump is going to be focused on punishing his enemies. I wish he would rather reward his friends. I think that's a better approach. But he is going to try to go after the 10 people that voted to impeach him in the House and perhaps a couple senators that he doesn't like. We'll see how he does. I don't think that helps the Republicans take the House back, which is the single most important thing we can do from our perspective to save the country.
Well, and Jamal,
Robert, it's important to take a moment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's important to take a moment to recognize that the Republican Party has moved so far that Dick Cheney's daughter is considered to be out of step with the Republican conference, and someone who Democrats thought was about as far, you know, to the right as one could get would be Dick Cheney. I just think that it's an incredibly perilous moment for the Republican Party and therefore for the democracy.
Well, and therefore for Democrats, because I'm looking at Texas. There were some tea leaves there this week. The Democrats' top candidate in the race for the 6th district, where, you know, in that county, Beto O'Rourke, Biden, you know, did well, but the Democrat didn't advance to a runoff. You know, you are, expressing sort of discomfort even about what's happening in the Republican Party, but do you worry that that will redound on you, affect you?
I mean, you know, Tom Friedman has been out talking about this for the last couple of days, that there is some concern about the laws that are taking place, the voting restrictions that are taking place that that also are imperiling our democracy. I think that I'm concerned because I think the Republicans are a major party line. Some people wear blue jerseys and they will, I'm sorry, wear red jerseys and they will vote for whoever the Republican is that, you know, is on the ballot. And so we all always have to be concerned that person is at least going to believe in the democracy. They're going to believe that outcome of elections matter, that legal judgments matter, and that we should all abide by a certain set of rules, which right now Donald Trump and the people who are following him don't believe in.
Yeah. Matt McCoviat, the Republican in our roundtable, just in the couple minutes we have, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is said to be a favorite to replace Liz Cheney. Why?
Well, she's a rising star. I couldn't have greater excitement about that prospect. She has understood and I think handled well that line between representing your constituency, being principled, but also not sort of poking the Trump bear, which is just not a good strategy. Set the substance of it aside, set the moralizing aside. You cannot go against a former president of the United States who has enormous support among your primary voters. And she's walked that tightrope in New York very well. She's been in a swing seat that I think is basically not a swing seat anymore. She's highly intelligent. She's younger. She's dynamic. She has a great story. I know a bit about her, and I think she would be an outstanding choice. And I do think they will select a woman to replace Liz Cheney as conference chair. And I think that's important. We need women at the leadership table, and that's a pretty visible role.
Go, Jamal.
Robin, can I just inject one note of good news before we go, or for Democrats,
sure.
Which is I do think that Joe Biden is running such an effective government. He's delivering on promises. He's doing more than even Democrats thought that he was going to do in the beginning. And it is very possible that everybody running on a Joe Biden ballot line will benefit from how well he is governing this country.
Or while we're all watching what happens with the latest Donald Trump drama, he's actually doing something in Washington, is I think what you're saying. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Matt McCoviat, the Republican. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
In Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti is pledging free public transit to students and lower-income residents. It's part of a larger plan to bring back riders to the city's subways and buses as COVID restrictions lift and people get vaccinated. Across the country, public transit agencies are also looking to rebuild ridership decimated by this pandemic. And let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan for more. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So in the last year, L.A. Metro ridership has fallen to about half of what it was at its peak. This is a story that's similar all across the country. It actually makes sense because we're in a pandemic. So how are these cities trying to lure riders back?
Yeah, at one point, the BART system up in San Francisco was down like 85 to 90%, really staggering numbers. The systems are basically going to have to compete for riders in ways that they didn't always have to. In a city like New York, the subway could take for granted that a lot of people were going to use the subway because it was just the most convenient way to get around. When trains are less frequent some places and roads are not as congested with cars, the equation changes. So you've got some systems lowering fares in some cases, maybe for certain groups of people, the students, the elderly, and so forth. Also changing their schedules. It's not all about rush hour anymore. Sometimes in the middle of the day, you have to wait a really long time for a train or a bus. So they're addressing the fact that now some people want to travel at those times of the day.
Okay, so there's the pandemic, but then there's also crime. We're hearing about how there are more police officers in New York, for example, patrolling the subways because there's been a spate of random attacks there. But a couple of years ago, there was a lot of pushback and protest over another proposed plan to increase police presence in the subways in New York City. So how will this help convince riders to return in that case?
Yeah, it's a matter of getting that balance right, kind of like the broader debates we have in society, right, Tanya? Everybody wants to feel safe. They want to feel like the police are there to protect them and not as a threat to them. And that's really what that's about. A lot of it just comes down to, with sparse ridership, sometimes if you have an empty train car, it's just opportunity crime that you might not have had a few years ago. So people want to feel protected. And, I think as long as transit police departments get that mix right, people will appreciate the layer of protection because the world has changed in so many ways.
I have about a minute with you, but I know Biden's infrastructure plan includes $85 billion over 8 years to modernize public transit systems. But the reality is more and more Americans are planning to telework permanently long after we're out of this pandemic. So what's the argument for investing in public transit right now?
Yeah, and for perspective, Tanya, $85 billion. I know these days we're talking about billions and trillions, and it, you know, sometimes hard to understand
it's
how much
to
the money
your
is.
Around.
To, mm-hmm. Yeah, to a lot of us who, you know, $1 million is a lot of money to us, right? But the federal transit budget each year is usually just $11 billion. So that's a lot of money for new subway cars and bridges. And converting vehicles to electric, for example, also helping climate goals. A lot of money there. The argument is that, look, in the long term, there's no telling what cities are going to look like. And if, mm-hmm. if we had assumed that nobody was going to want to be in New York City after 9/11, let's say, that would have been a poor decision in terms of transportation planning then. So, yes, right now,
we'll
ridership
pick up this
is
conversation
down. People
to talk more about this at another time. Thank you so much, Seth. That's Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. As always, thank you so much. David Oyelowo has been described as an actor's actor for taking on meaty roles like his depiction of Martin Luther King Jr. in the 2014 film Selma.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed.
Well, now Oyelowo is making his directing debut with The Waterman. In the film, Lonnie Chavez plays Gunnar, a boy whose family moves to a rural town where legend has it a mystical being called the Waterman lives in a nearby forest and is said to hold the secret to immortality. Gunnar is fascinated by this, especially as his mother is seriously ill. Here's a scene with David Oyelowo, who also stars in the film, playing Gunnar's father.
If you had to choose between a short life with a lot of love in it and a very long life with no one left to love, which one would you choose?
I would take a short life with your mom in it, then a long one without her.
The Waterman opens in theaters this Friday, and David Oyelowo joins me now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the transition from acting is a natural one, but not necessarily a step that many actors take. What made you want to direct now at this point in your career?
I just love every aspect of storytelling, and there are stories I want to see in the world. I can either complain about them not existing, or I could do something to make them exist. And, you know, I've done that to a certain degree with producing films. The Waterman is actually the sixth, but it's the first one I've directed. And, you know, if you want to see something exist, the best thing to do is to build it yourself.
What are some surprises about yourself that you learned while directing?
Well, you know, one of the things that was impossible to know and is also impossible to rehearse is what it is going to be like to direct yourself on a set where there are hundreds of people dependent on your ability to move things along in order to be able to get each scheduled day in the can. And the idea of giving a performance, but also having to dedicate a part of my brain and attention to what the other people are doing in the scene, what's going on with the shooting day in its totality, whether I'm giving a remotely decent performance. You know, that was a lot to juggle, but I had my wife on set with me, especially at the beginning, just to call BS on anything I was doing in front of the camera that just felt silly. And because she knows me more than anyone on the planet, and she would happily tell me if I was playing any false notes. But I came to learn that, you know, thankfully I've been given so many beautiful opportunities as an actor that I know what a performance should feel like. And it meant I still had enough of a capacity and a capability to concentrate on the other stuff as well.
Thank goodness for partners who can remind you of who you are call you on your BS.
Yeah, she was invaluable for me.
Well, this film has a mystical element. The Waterman is said to be able to cheat death. What drew you to this story?
Well, I had grown up on films the likes of which Steven Spielberg particularly made a lot of earlier on in his career, E.T. being a huge favorite. Stand By Me was a big one for me growing up. Close Encounters, Gremlins, mm-hmm. you know, these were all films that interspersed reality and fantasy. They were escapism and adventure, but laced with some meaning. And I remember watching those films with my parents, with my brothers. And I just saw, as a parent of four kids myself, there were less of these films being made. And so when this script came onto the blacklist in, I think it was 2015, I fought hard to get it because I wanted to see films of this nature in the world again.
It also evokes a timeless story. You mentioned E.T. There are references right off the top of E.T. and Sherlock Holmes, kind of evoking in those who are older our childhood wonder, you know, of those types of films that we love through the generations. We have a scene where Gunnar reaches out to a local man who claims to know all about the Waterman. He's played by Alfred Molina, and he's not happy about Gunnar being on his doorstep. Let's listen.
Is this a prank? Where are your friends, huh? Where are they hiding? Where are your buddies with the cameras?
Mr. Bussy, right?
Yeah, well, I warned you, kids. You pulled another prank, I'd call the police.
It's not a prank. I just want to know if the Waterman is real.
Lonnie Chavis, who plays Gunnar, is only 13, but he's already an experienced actor. He's appeared on the TV show Supergirl and This Is Us. What was it like directing someone that young?
Gosh, this guy is very, very special. He was only 11 when we shot the film, and he is the definition. Yeah, he was. He's the definition of a needle in a haystack. I mean, for this film to even remotely begin to work, you needed a young person with immense emotional intelligence because there are themes in the film that, you know, are quite sophisticated when it comes to the idea of loss and sacrificial love and friendship. And, you know, the demands of the script and the story on Lonnie were not just to go out and have an adventure as a young person. It was to really have to face the notion of what loss means and whether he can live with it, and if he can't live with it, how to navigate going out into the woods in order to find this mythical figure who supposedly has the ability to cheat death, and why.
Well, this is a story that has a Black family at the center of it, but that's not a plot point. We've been talking a lot about representation in Hollywood, in addition to having films like Selma or Judas and the Black Messiah or One Night in Miami, where a major through line is the character's racial identity. How important was it for you to depict a storyline like The Waterman, where the Black family's racial identity is not at the center of the plot line?
Well, to me, you know, a film like The Waterman, where that is not the focus of the story, is just as important as those other films from a representation point of view, maybe even more important at this stage in our cultural history, because we're used to seeing those stories that are very specifically tied to race. What is still relatively anomalous and rare is a film the likes of The Waterman, the likes of which I loved growing up, but never really saw myself represented within. And, you know, a huge focus of mine is the normalization of the marginalized. You know, what you see in The Waterman is the kind of situation anyone and everyone who has been a child, has been a parent, has been a friend can relate to. Not necessarily the fantasy elements, but certainly in terms of what the family is dealing with. Especially in this year we've just had with the coronavirus, I think films of this nature that do this kind of work where race is not at the center, they are incredibly culturally important.
Well, David, you are a busy man, a director, an award-winning actor, a humanitarian, and now you're lending your name to this effort to promote the importance of vaccines. It's part of the One Campaign. Why was it important for you to be part of this effort?
It has become very clear that one of our main ways out of this thing is to embrace these vaccines that have so brilliantly been expedited to the point whereby they have reached us in record time. I understand the trepidation. I understand the reservation. I've had some of them myself, but in talking to experts, thankfully, you know, I have the kind of notoriety that means I have that kind of access. I personally have become satisfied with the fact that this is the silver bullet we need against this virus. And so having built up that confidence, I felt able to join with one and other initiatives of this nature to hopefully give people confidence that this is something to embrace, because we all want to get back to work. We all want to get back to our lives.
That's right. We definitely do. We all want to see each other again in person.
Yes, we certainly do.
David Oyelowo is the director and stars in the new film, The Waterman. David, thank you so much.
This has been a real delight. Thank you.
How can the U.S. cut carbon emissions in half by 2030, as President Biden has pledged? Well, one answer, rewire the country's power grid. President Biden's infrastructure plan includes $100 billion to replace thousands of miles of transmission lines, something compared to redesigning the national highway system. But transmission projects have failed for decades. Let's find out why from Lauren Azar, transmission expert and former advisor to the U.S. Department of Energy under President Obama. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Transmission lines, not sexy, except in Jimmy Webb's song, Wichita Lineman, but so important, we understand, for cutting emissions. Why?
Well, if you think about where we're heading to get to net zero carbon, we're going to need to electrify the economy, which means that demand is likely to double for electricity. So that means we're going to need a lot more generators than we currently have. And those generators will likely be located in diverse locations. As you know, the sun shines more strongly in some areas than others, and the wind blows harder in some parts of the country and certainly offshore. And so to get the biggest bang for your buck, you want to put the majority of your generators where that fuel source is strongest, which means we need transmission from those locations to the customers.
Well, we saw this during the winter storm in Texas. Texas pretty much lost power, and they couldn't get it from another part of the country.
Exactly. And the Texas event is a perfect example of why we need a strong transmission grid to be able to access generators in a lot of different locations.
Right. And we're also going to have more electric cars in the future. They need to be powered. We need to have power stations for them. We need to spread this power out. So take us through the biggest barriers. Experts have divided them into three categories: planning, permitting, paying.
Let's start with planning. So you started with the analogy about the interstate highway system. It's great to think about planning the transmission system the same way. You need to ensure that the segments are connected. You need to ensure that there are enough lanes so it can accommodate peak traffic. And you need to ensure that the off-ramps are located appropriately so that you can get to customers or population centers. Very similar to transmission. But currently, those who are responsible for planning and building the transmission grid aren't required to have the same vision or plan for the same kind of future. So they don't have to agree on how many generators need to be built. They don't have to agree on where those generators are going to be built. As a consequence, we aren't able to take a 80,000-foot view and come up with an overarching plan to develop the most cost-effective transmission grid that we can.
And what about permitting and paying for it?
So with a few exceptions, permitting and siting are done at either the state level and in some cases on the local level. So imagine when building the federal highway system, if a single town could simply say no, not here. That does happen when building transmission lines right now. And for long lines or interstate transmission lines, it can take anywhere from 5 to 15 years to complete them because of requiring state and federal approvals, as well as sometimes local approvals. And as far as paying for those lines, that's also a tricky proposition when you're talking about these larger lines that are crossing states or crossing entire regions. Everybody agrees that the customers that are benefiting from those lines should pay for them. But actually deciding who are the beneficiaries is less than clear. So there are many, many, I can say, fights over this.
Well, there are tax incentives in Biden's plan to try to get developers, people who would do this, on board. But you always have that notion that there are Americans who don't want it in their backyard. They think transmission lines are an eyesore. Now, we know in some parts of the country, these transmission lines are being put underground to avoid fires, for instance. But some, because of the way they deliver electricity, it's too expensive to do that. So how do you get people on board with, a highway system? Everybody was buying cars at the time. They could see that future. How do you get people excited?
Well, from my perspective, electricity literally is the lifeblood of our economy. And so I would hope that people would get excited about that. I have not had very much success in getting that done. I can tell you that there are some transmission tower artists that have made these beautiful transmission towers that some of them look like people dancing and are holding the line. So I don't know if that would get folks excited about transmission line near them, but that would be one option. Obviously, to the extent we can get new technologies that would allow us to bury the lines more cost effectively, I would hope that would also facilitate more development of it.
We'll post those pictures at hearnow.org. Lauren Azar, transmission expert, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.